You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Most of us would be pretty hard-pressed to remember when the election of a new president has resulted in such strong reactions for and against. But that's what our nation has been going through since Donald Trump was elected to be our 45th president. Many are afraid of life under President Trump based on his campaign messages that regularly targeted people based on religion, gender, ethnicity, race, and more. And they wonder, why would someone vote for this candidate? And they look at those who did vote for Trump as racists. Saeed Khan is hoping we all might take a more measured, nuanced, and thoughtful view. He's a lecturer at Wayne State University's College of Liberal Arts and Science, and he teaches a course on Muslim-Christian diversity at Rochester College. Saeed Khan, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
You wrote this editorial for Religion News that caught our eye, speaking as a Muslim American about the attitudes that you've observed towards people who voted for Donald Trump. I guess first off, I have to ask, did you vote for Mr. Trump?
No, I did not.
Okay, so we have that right off the table because people are going to wonder. But you are arguing in your editorial that you don't think that all Donald Trump supporters are racist. Why is that?
Well, a lot of it has to do with my experience. I grew up in the buzzing metropolis of Lapeer, and I happened to be there in high school during the recession of the early 80s. Being 20 miles east of Flint, an hour north of Detroit, Lapeer is a feeder community, primarily for the auto industry as well as for a state home for the mentally impaired within Lapeer. And when the recession hit, we have, of course, the plant closings in Pontiac, in Flint particularly, as well as in Detroit. And then we also had the closing of Oakdale. And so we have essentially two-thirds of the workforce of Lapeer was decimated. And so my neighbors, my classmates, my colleagues, my dad's patients, he's a physician, he's still a physician in Lapeer, all of us felt this recession. It was not a matter of saying, oh, well, here we are a doctor's family, so we are not feeling an impact. Yes, we were certainly comfortable compared to others, but when you find that patients of my dad, for example, or my schoolmates coming to school without having a regular supply of meals, maybe the lunch that they were having in the cafeteria was their primary meal for the day. Two parents who were working the line now are without a job, without any prospect for a job, without health insurance. This was the era, this was the climate in which I grew up, in a place which also spawned the Michigan militia, Jim and Terry Nichols of Oklahoma City bombing fame. And yet there was a dignity among the people of Lapeer that we were in this together. This was like out of Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska album. Mm-hmm. We were living it every day. And patients would come to my dad's office and would be very sheepish, saying, Doc, we can't come to our follow-up appointment because we don't have any health insurance. Everything's gone. And my dad says, well, you're going to have to find a job, and you can't find a job if you're sick. So why don't we go ahead and worry about those things later? And my dad let quite a few people ride. Well, a few years later, when the economy picked up, we also discovered that many people had, in fact, left Lapeer for warmer and perhaps more economically promising areas like the South and the Southwest. And he started getting checks and letters from postmarks that he didn't know anybody there, Arizona,
Texas,
yes. New Mexico, and he would open them up, and there would be a letter saying, Doc, you did so much for us, we just wanted to let you know that we're okay, and here's a check. We know it's not going to cover everything that you did for us, but we want you to know that you were there for us, and we appreciate it so much. My dad told me just a few weeks ago, he said, the story that I didn't tell you about this, or the additional fact, he says, I put these checks on my desk in my office, and I wept. He says, I just realized the dignity, the integrity of people who didn't have to do this. I mean, it was pretty much written off. I didn't see them again because they had moved on. But the fact that they recognized that this was a community that had come together during such economic and social pressure. And unfortunately, for many people in Lapeer and so many communities like it, the economic recovery didn't come back.
So we're saying, like, looking ahead 30 years to where we are today.
And within the last 30 years, we had another big recession, mind you. And so we find then two generations have gone by where a lot of the promise for either a return of manufacturing jobs or some kind of economic stability simply bypassed places like Lapeer, simply bypassed places like Davison, the home of Michael Moore, just 10 miles away. And so that was the demographic that was now overwhelmingly finding some promise with Trump's rhetoric.
And not hearing what they needed to hear from Hillary Clinton?
Definitely. It was not falling on deaf ears. It was basically a mute tongue. And what we find then is this is a community where my parents still live 37 years later. They were there during 9/11. There was never an ounce of racism. There was never a matter of bigotry. My parents don't live in an unlisted address or with an unlisted phone number. Everyone knows where Doc Khan is. Everyone knows where Mrs. Khan is. They shop at Meijer. They shop at Kroger. And we find that despite all of the rhetoric that was certainly coming out of social media and on the network news, they were really immune. And in fact, people—
But that rhetoric wasn't coming out of the network news. The network news was had cameras at rallies reporting things said by the candidate, reporting reactions of the people at the rallies.
Absolutely true. But in many ways, it's the same accusation that was being made about Trump, that although he may not have been tweeting something, he was retweeting it. So in a way, the media network news was being an inadvertent amplifier.
So they have not covered that, the rallies? Or the
No. Yeah. No. I think that they most certainly should have covered it, mm-hmm. because I think that it's important. This is a moment of journalism, and it would be journalistic malpractice not to cover this. But as far as how the audience was receiving the message, it is undeniable that this is what they were absorbing. And despite that, we find that there was not the kind of embeddedness or influence of that rhetoric when it came to voting. Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act was causing premiums to increase. People were very nervous about that. There was still this idea that so much of the manufacturing base is just simply going away. And I would even submit that the situation of the water in Flint was yet just one more reminder of how the infrastructure and about how the economy of this once vibrant area had collapsed. 37 years ago, when we moved to Flint, Flint had a population of 225,000. Now it is under 100,000. So here you have this large city with a decaying infrastructure with less than half the population. That's not just a metaphor. That is a lived experience every single day for people.
In your piece, in your editorial for Religion News, you make an argument that to infer that all Donald Trump supporters are out-and-out racist or harboring racist impulses, in your words, is ironically absurd as those who contend all Muslims are terrorists.
Yeah. So the last 15 years has certainly been interesting since 9/11. And there have been more than one occasion that I have been called to task to go ahead and disavow and denounce terrorism, which I, of course, have no problem doing. But it certainly becomes very, very tiresome to do so, because what it comes down to is saying, well, you may not be a terrorist,
but
you are Muslim and Muslims are engaged in terrorist activity. Therefore, you need to be the emissary and speak out against terrorism. So looking at the analogous situation and knowing full hand from some people who are not in any capacity, even in their subconscious, racist, who voted for Trump based on the idea of economics for themselves and for their families, to go ahead and then infer that they might be racist by some kind of strange
calculus
of saying, well, not all Trump supporters are racist, but all racists supported Trump. These kinds of binaries really don't work well.
But I've got to ask you, how can people, as they think about who voted for Donald Trump, how do you tell people to get past actions of some Trump supporters, such as whomever sent a hate-filled letter to mosques in East Lansing and Ann Arbor? I'm going to say, quote, just a tiny part, not much, because it's a revolting letter, but here's a quote. There's a new sheriff in town, President Donald Trump. He's going to cleanse America and make it shine again, and he's going to start with you Muslims. How do people on the receiving end of those attitudes, Saeed, keep themselves from feeling as though anyone who voted for Donald Trump is at least a fellow traveler?
I know it's very, very difficult, and it is very troubling. I think what's even more troubling and essentially a slap in the face is that when that happens in a place like Ann Arbor, or when it happens in a place like New York City, where a young Muslim woman is pushed down the stairs in a subway and people are yelling Trump, or it's happening in a place like San Francisco, these are multicultural, cosmopolitan areas where people think that there should be more tolerance. And here's where the irony is again, that it seems as though there is perhaps less of this fervor in places that seem improbable. Why is it that in a place like Lapeer, it's not happening, yet in a place like Ann Arbor, it is? What I think that means is that we have to get away from a sense of complacency, that these things can happen anywhere. And what then is the reason that people are feeling emboldened and empowered to make such scurrilous statements and to demonize people? I would suggest that it has to do with what they feel is a newfound sense or a renewed sense of power. And that's paradoxical because, generally speaking, those who make these statements themselves are powerless.
Where'd that power come from?
That power came from the pulpit. It came from somebody who seems to be normalizing or at least making it seem as though it is legitimate to speak in such a ways and maybe even act out on certain impulses.
So meaning the candidate.
Meaning the candidate. And I have to also say that it's not just Trump himself. Unfortunately, we find that he is in many ways the culmination and the convergence of rhetoric that has been going on for some time. Trump is simply a one-stop shop, a kind of a Walmart for toxic rhetoric, in the sense that he has demonized several different demographic groups. At the same time, we're also looking at coming out of what was one of the most transformative presidencies in recent time in history, with the election and the re-election of an African-American president. One of the bellwethers that we also have to be mindful of in which this is operating is that America is moving toward becoming a majority-minority country, probably within about a generation, as most demographers are having. So there is a group of people who feel as though that essentialized American identity is eroding, and they're not sure what that's going to mean. The first step, of course, is a kind of an economic decline. There's a cultural decline. There may be even an erosion of American influence around the world with globalization. So this then becomes a perfect storm, where you then find, if you want to call it last gasps, death throes and spasms, or just simply people who feel emboldened to act on certain impulses that were either dormant or have now become rejuvenated, they are now making these statements.
Saeed, I spoke with Reverend Jesse Jackson when he was in town just a few days after the election, and I asked him, put this question to him, you know, what of the people all across Michigan, like the people you describe, your neighbors in Lapeer, who feel economic pressures, that they feel, as you put it in your editorial, desperation for a better life, and that Hillary Clinton wasn't speaking to you, so they voted for Trump. And here's what he said.
The economic consternation is real. The scapegoating is wrong. That's why Bernie Sanders and Trump had the same appeal to that group of people. And so people have been led to vote for Trump. You have to excuse the anti-feelings toward Muslims and African-Americans and Latinos and women. That's a lot to jump over just to vote.
So he's basically saying that doesn't get the economic stress doesn't excuse the fact that this racism was so blatant. What do you say to that?
Well, again, I mean, there is no excuse for the racism. There's no excuse for the bigotry, and there's certainly no excuse for acting on those impulses. This is garden variety bullying. There's no other word for it. I mean, we can go ahead and parse it by saying it's anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, homophobia, etc., but it comes down to simply bullying. And in that, I think we realize that everyone is in the same boat. All of these groups don't have to see themselves as distinct, siloed victims of a kind of demonization, but they are all victims of the same kind of bullying. At the same time, I still have to think that it is not for us to necessarily impute upon people the luxury of being able to separate high principles and virtues from the reality of everyday life and what is not being provided for them.
We talk about needing to come together. But I know, even based on emails that I've received from people who listen to interviews on the show who do not want to hear why anyone would have voted for Donald Trump. I had one email from a physician who said she was so upset the day after the election that she wanted to put a sign on her door saying, if you voted for Trump, go away. She didn't do it, but she said, I thought about it very seriously. And she took great issue with the fact that we actually had someone who voted for Trump so we could try to talk, you know, tell us why. So how do we bring this together into a sense of, you know what, we're Americans because we've got everybody pretty, you use the term siloed, and I feel like that's where we have a lot of America right now on both sides.
Well, one of the issues, of course, is the convenience by which one can live in a silo. Social media feeds, for example, are notorious for this. I, in fact, asked my my class the very morning after the election. I said, "How many of you had a Facebook feed which was diversified? How many of you had some messages which were different from how you're feeling?" And to a student, they all said, none of us.
Because you can hide the ones that rankle you.
You can block. You can unlike. You can go ahead and live within that comfort zone because, of course, there's so much information and so much rhetoric out there. But I said, you're living then in a fool's paradise. What is happening then is you realize for your entire Facebook feed, which is morose, which is mourning, which is crying, there is a parallel Facebook feed which is jubilant, which is celebrating, which claims that we finally won one. I said there needs to be bridges across these silos.
So what is your call to action? In this piece that, you wrote for Religion News, what did you feel is the kernel of your call to action?
Well, the essence really is getting out of bubbles. The one luxury that I've had, which is actually born of necessity, was to get out of bubbles. Every time I walked out of my front door in Lapeer, even now, especially with the benefit of being at a very diverse multicultural campus like Wayne State, that has not been very difficult for me. I can see how easy it is to fall back into a bubble because it is comfortable, it is warm, it is cushy, but I also find that long term it is fatal to live like that. To have those difficult conversations, you have to build trust. I find that the very same conversation that we have when people are standoffish, when people are not sure about you, they are suspicious, is totally different than once you establish a little bit of trust and you can go ahead then and broach subjects which otherwise you couldn't. I have never found a situation where people do not have some kind of a meeting of the minds. This is not about conversion. This is not missionary work. This is not proselytization. It's just simply gaining an understanding of people. And people are still going to agree to disagree, but at least there won't be that venom or that toxicity to it.
Saeed Khan, lecturer at Wayne State University. You'll find his editorial, "I am a heartland Muslim and I don't think all Trump supporters are racist," by going to religionnews.com. Saeed, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.